Scott, why did Russia change its top military commander again in this war?
Well, the situation changes. General Surovikin was appointed back in October at a time when the Russian military was in a very difficult position. They had overextended their lines. They had insufficient resources. The Ukrainians, backed up by tens of billions of dollars worth of Western equipment, were launching attacks that were having some success. And so there was a need to bring stability and order to the Russian lines while Russia underwent partial mobilization to bring 300,000 plus troops to the combat zone. So that was the general's task, and he succeeded in admirable fashion. The lines were stabilized. The Ukrainians, their offensive was stopped. The Russians continued, offensive operations in the Donetsk region, which have had great success. They just captured Soledar. They're threatening to capture Bakhmut. But now, and not only that, the General Surovikin oversaw an expansion of the air campaign that has destroyed the Ukrainian economy, destroyed it, absolutely destroyed it, and its ability to sustain conflict. It's not just about attacking civilian infrastructure, it's about attacking the nation's ability to wage war. And General Surovikin has severely degraded Ukraine's ability to wage conflict. The fact is, Condoleezza Rice and Robert Gates, two former senior U.S. officials, have recently co-authored an opinion piece in the Washington Post where they say, without continued injection of billions of dollars of Western financial assistance, the Ukrainian economy would collapse. And that's because of General Surovikin. So he's not a failure. He's a success. In fact, at the end of last year, President Vladimir Putin awarded him a very senior military honor, the Order of St. George, which is given for extraordinary military accomplishment. So clearly this man is doing something right. But now the time has come where 300,000 reservists have been mobilized, trained, equipped. Russia is getting ready to change the nature of the conflict. Vladimir Putin himself said that this, because of the intervention of the collective West, this is no longer a special military operation. This is war. And so now Russia is getting ready to wage war. Generals are good. There's no doubt that generals provide the command presence and they lead by example. But what wins a war is the general's staff, the people underneath him who can organize the forces logistically, operationally, communications. And the staff of General Surovikin is limited in what it can do and limited in what it cannot. And what it cannot do is oversee an expanded conflict that may, I'm not saying will, but may bring in a whole new front out of Belarus, a whole new front out of Belgorod, and expand the air campaign to a strategic air campaign, a standalone course of action that focuses on not only continuing the destruction of Ukraine's ability to economically sustain war, but physically interdict the West's ability to reinforce Ukraine. Each one of these tasks requires a staff that is equivalent to the staff that General Surovikin currently has underneath him. So you can't sit here and expect General Surovikin to adequately manage the totality of what Russia's getting ready to do with the staff that he possesses. It's a good staff, but that staff is focused on a very limited objective. If you're going to expand the conflict, you have to expand the command and staff structure that supports the conflict. And so what they've done is wisely brought in General Gennady Gerasimov, the chief of staff of the Russian Armed Forces, a very experienced general officer, and they put him in charge of the overall operation. And then they've broken the conflict zone into different categories. And General Serovikin is now his deputy in charge of the air campaign. He hasn't been demoted. He's been rewarded for doing a very difficult job and doing it well. And now he's being reassigned so that his skill set can be maximized. This is what armies do when they're getting ready to expand the operation. You know, in the Battle of Stalingrad, there was a General Chuikov who commanded, I believe, the Soviet, I want to say 42nd Army, I could be wrong on this. And for a while, he was the center focus. He was the man. He was doing all the fighting, defending. But when the Soviets said, we are going to expand the nature of the conflict so it's beyond the city and now involves enveloping operations, it brought in a higher command structure. Does that, General Zhukov, does that mean that Chuikov was a failure? Was he demoted? Was he a disgrace? No, he was a hero. But the war had grown beyond his ability to control. And that's what happened with General Serovikin. He did an amazing job. And now the war has expanded. And with it, the Russian command structure is expanding. And they're bringing in somebody who, as good as General Armageddon was, General Gerasimov's better. And he's better equipped and better trained and better prepared to provide adequate command and control over this expanded military operation that everybody anticipates is going to unfold in the near future.
Scott, how this one war going to end? Because how Russia sees this as, I don't know what means victory to Russia. When they going to end this war?
Well, I mean, Russia's been quite clear what means victory. They've said it from day one. Demilitarization, that is the total destruction of the Ukrainian armed forces, and denazification, which now means the total destruction of the Zelensky government. That's how you win the war, and Russia's getting ready to win the war. When Russia finishes this current military campaign, I believe the Ukrainian army will be physically destroyed. That's demilitarization. Now, tragically, this means that tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Ukrainian soldiers are going to lose their lives. This is going to be a slaughter, a massacre. But they opted for this, so they pay the price. Now, part of this, I believe, this expanded military operation will include a dedicated strategic air campaign that will focus on destroying the nation of Ukraine. Destroying it. There will be no viable functioning nation when this air campaign is done. And by destroying that, you will cause the political collapse of the Zelensky government. The Zelensky government will be no more. It'll be replaced by another government that will be, I believe, prepared to accept unconditional terms of surrender from Russia that include the denazification process, that is, constitutional changes in the Ukrainian government that outlaws the ideology of Stepan Bandera, outlaws political parties that have embraced the ideology of Stepan Bandera, and put in place adequate societal control mechanisms to ensure that this odious ideology never again rears its ugly head. That's denazification. Now the war is over. I just explained to you how this is going to happen. It's going to happen this year, I believe. It's going to happen at the cost of the Ukrainian nation. It's going to happen with the sacrifice of the Ukrainian people. But it's going to happen.
But it's going to happen before summer coming along, or it's going to...
No, I you know, nothing happens quickly. And if anything, the Russians have said, you know, they're not driven by a calendar. Russia's not putting an artificial date up there. We must be in Kiev by Victory Day. No. All they're saying is we will accomplish the mission. Demilitarization, denazification. You know, one of the things the Russians have learned is that they're not in control of the overall situation. They can't control how much equipment the West provides. Understand that, you know, the West is the equivalent of a drug dealer for the addict that is Ukraine. The addict can only function if the addict has continued access to narcotics. And the West is the supplier of the narcotics. So long as the West continues to supply the Ukrainian addict with drugs, then this problem will exist. You know, Russia will do its best to squeeze out the supply of narcotics and subject the Ukrainian addict to a rehabilitation program. Now, that's a cute way of saying they're going to kill a lot of Ukrainians and they're going to destroy the Zelensky government. And they're probably going to destroy the Ukrainian nation. But, you know, addiction is a self-destructive process and Ukraine only has itself to blame. But this is a process that's not driven by the calendar. It's driven by results. But in looking at, for instance, demilitarization, I don't see how the Ukrainian military, even if it receives even more assistance from the West, will be able to stay on the battlefield past this summer. So by fall, I expect the Ukrainian military to be destroyed. At the same time, I expect that the Ukrainian economy will be absolutely gutted, tragically so, but gutted. And even if the Ukrainian government staggers into fall and winter of 2023, it won't survive the winter. Ukraine won't survive the winter. This winter has been tough. Next winter will be fatal. It's all over for Ukraine. The tragedy is that the Ukrainian people and their supporters in the West don't see this, don't recognize this. So they're going to continue this Wagnerian tragedy, believing that somehow through sacrifice there will be redemption. But there won't be. The only thing there will be is death, the death of Ukraine.
Actually, the Ukrainian Defense Ministry the other day was giving an interview. He said that we are fighting, we are carrying out the NATO's mission. And we are shedding our blood. They are not shedding. So NATO's member should have, they have to provide us with weapons. How? I found it so, I don't know. The first part admits that they're fighting a proxy war in Ukraine. The second part says that we are prepared to fight to the last Ukrainian. How?
You know, what's interesting is in July of 2022, the Center for Countering Disinformation at an entity that belongs under the presidency of Ukraine published a blacklist. And I'm on the blacklist as a Russian propagandist. I'm an information terrorist, and I'm a war criminal. And but one of the things that they listed three reasons why I was a war criminal and information terrorist. And the first one was that I was saying that the Ukrainian-Russian conflict was a proxy conflict between NATO and Russia. So I fully anticipate that the Ukrainian Minister of Defense will now join me on the blacklist, because he is obviously a Russian propagandist, because he is pursuing a pro-Russian narrative and saying and having the gall to say that Ukraine is fighting on behalf of NATO against Russia. I said the truth back then. Now Ukraine has no choice but to admit the truth, because they're in a desperate situation. They can no longer play games. They have to call NATO out, because NATO has set Ukraine up to fail. That's the tragedy of this whole thing. NATO and the West do not care about Ukraine. They do not care about the Ukrainian people. They don't care about the Ukrainian soldiers. They are more than happy to let them continue to die on the battlefield because the West will never support Ukrainian victory. I mean, they'll do it rhetorically, but they'll never give them the resources necessary, because simply put, Ukraine cannot beat Russia. It's physically impossible for a nation the size of Ukraine to defeat a nation the size of Russia. It just won't happen. But the West continues to, you know, fool Ukraine into believing that's a viable mission. Go ahead and do it. But we know what the West's intent is. It's not to have Ukraine emerge victorious. The West has already said Ukraine will never be a member of NATO. Never. Never be a member of NATO. It's just not going to happen. And yet Ukraine thinks that somehow, if they continue to sacrifice, NATO will welcome with open arms. The European Union gives lip service to Ukraine joining the European Union, but the European Union can't absorb an economy that no longer functions. $1 trillion of damage to the infrastructure. It's going to cost even more than that to bring Ukraine back up, if it ever can be back up. So Ukraine will never be a member of the West. Never. Never, ever, ever. It isn't going to happen. And yet the Ukrainians continue to die, believing that somehow it is going to happen. It isn't. The West is sacrificing Ukraine for the sole purpose of harming Russia. That's all. They don't want to help Ukraine. They don't like Ukraine. They want to destroy Ukraine. And that's what's happening. And finally, the Minister of Defense of Ukraine is saying the truth. Hey, guys, we're doing your dirty business. You know, it's not a dirty business. It just happened. Remember, Angela Merkel, Hollande, the former French president, Poroshenko, all say that the Minsk Accords of 2014-2015 were a sham. A sham. They didn't want peace. They wanted war. They wanted to buy time so that NATO could train the Ukrainian military that would be capable of confronting the pro-Russian separatists or rebels in the Donbas and liberate Crimea, meaning war, war, war. That's what the West wanted from day one. This was a proxy conflict from day one. The proxy conflict predated Russia's decision to intervene militarily on February 24th. It predated the 2014 fighting in the Donbas. It predated the decision to invite Ukraine in 2008. It goes back to the lies told by the West to then Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev that NATO would not expand if Russia left East Germany. If Russia voluntarily left East Germany, withdrew the 400,000 troops, that NATO would not expand one inch eastward. That is a direct quote from James Baker, then Secretary of State of the United States of America. We lied then because our policy has always been to exploit Russian weakness, to contain Russia, to undermine Russia for the purpose of having Russia collapse. That has been our objective from 1990. It's our objective today. And we're using Ukraine as the sacrificial lamb to achieve that objective. Unfortunately for Ukraine, Russia isn't playing that game. Russia's not rolling over. Russia's winning. Russia's going to win. Russia will prevail. The West will fail. But Ukraine will die.
How they can convince these people? I saw they're recruiting very young males, 20, 20, 22 years old. How it's so ugly to do such a thing to your nation.
You can't, if you call yourself a Ukrainian nationalist and you support what's going on today, you hate Ukraine. It's as simple as that. You hate Ukraine. You say, how do we solve this? I'm going to be brutally honest here. There's some problems that can only be solved with a bullet. When people have imbued hatred into their very existence. And remember, the Ukrainian nation is defined by its hatred. The modern Ukrainian state is defined by its hatred towards Russia. They're taught from the very beginning to call the Russians Muskov, which is a derogatory term. They call them orcs. The followers of Stepan Bandera view the Russians as subhumans. They slaughtered them during the 1940s and 1950s. 200,000 Russians. 110,000 Poles. These aren't good people. And you can't rehabilitate them. There's some you can. The non-believers, the people who have inadvertently been sucked into this situation. But the true believers, the ones who tattoo the swastika on their hand, who say Sieg Heil, who march, who murder, who shoot Russian prisoners of war, who speak about wanting to kill Russian children. There's only one solution. That's the bullet.
So sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they made the decision. They made the decision. It's a conscious decision on their part to do this. You know, we all come into the world equal in the eyes of our Creator. Children are not born evil. Children are born innocent. And what a child turns into as an adult is a direct byproduct of the environment that they are raised in. Let's take a look at your average Russian boy. They're not perfect. None of us are. No boys are perfect. We all know that. Boys are little devious little creatures growing up. But we're not evil. We want to do good. You know, you give a boy a chance. If somebody falls on the ground, will the boy laugh or will the boy go over and try and help the person up and assist them? And generally speaking, they will seek to help because they're programmed to do good. And your average Russian boy, young man in uniform, wants to do good. They don't want to hurt people. I mean, if called upon to fight, they will fight very well. But they, when they capture a Ukrainian, they treat them with respect as a human being. They offer a cigarette. They offer water. They treat the wounds. They say, do you want to have a phone call home? Not to mock their loved ones, but to give them the solace of knowing that their loved one is alive and will live and will survive this war. What did Ukrainians do? They kick them. They mock them. They shoot them on sight, or they beat them up, put them in a cell, torture them even more. When they call the family, they call the family to brag about killing people, about torturing them. They want to call family to make the family suffer. This isn't done. This doesn't happen by accident. And the fact that it's so widespread in Ukraine means that your average Ukrainian man has been programmed from childhood to believe this is okay, that Russians are subhuman, whereas your average Russian man has been programmed to treat the Ukrainians with respect, as co-equals, as fellow human beings. Yes, we can find deviations. I know for a fact there's Russians out there who are ultra-nationalistic nature, who call Ukrainians ho-ho, and they speak to them about pigs and wanting to fry the pigs. It's disgusting. It's disgusting. But it's in isolation. It's not reflective of the Russian totality. Whereas in Ukraine, the exception is the Ukrainian who speaks of the Russian well, who speaks of the Russian as equals, who speaks of them as fellow human beings. And most of those Ukrainians have an aspect of Russia in them, whether they are ethnic Russians themselves, whether they have parents there or relatives that are Russian, or there's something about them that lends itself to understanding that the Russians are human beings and co-equals. But the other Ukrainians, the nationalists, the ultra-nationalists, they've been programmed from very young to hate Russia and everything about Russia, and therefore torturing a Russian, taking an ethnic Russian, taping them up to a pole, pulling down their pants, painting their face green, and mocking them, leaving them exposed to the elements to suffer, is okay. There's Ukrainians here in the United States who say, it's just a pat on the butt. It's not a big deal, meaning when they spank these people, it's just a pat on the butt. It's a huge deal. It's a human rights violation, and it just shows a mindset that treats these people as something less than human. And when you have that in the head, how do you get it out? When the brain is so infected, how do you change it? And, you know, under Khrushchev, because this isn't the first go-around with Russia against this ideology, in the 1940s, late 1940s and early 1950s, the Banderist movement, the Organization for Ukrainian Nationalists, was engaged in large-scale resistance against the Soviets in Ukraine, in Poland, too. They were defeated. Thousands of them fled and created diaspora communities in Canada and the United States and Australia and elsewhere, where this Bandera ideology festers today. Today, 60 miles away from me in Ellenville, New York, there's the Heroes Park, where they have a statue of Stepan Bandera and four other Nazis, people with blood of Jews, Poles, and Russians on their hands. They call them heroes. Every summer, the Ukrainian youth gather there. Ukrainian American youth gather there. They wear uniforms that are direct replicas of the Nazi uniform. They have the Nazi salute. They carry the portrait of Bandera, flag of Azov. These are Nazis in America. They're sick people, mentally ill people. They exist in Canada as well. In Canada, it's even more mainstream. Their deputy prime minister, Chrystia Freeland, is a Nazi. She was raised as a Nazi. And she's there today promoting Nazi ideology in support of Ukraine. So it exists here. Russia militarily defeated this ideology in the 1950s. Those who didn't flee were imprisoned and subjected to political reprogramming. And then, instead of serving a 25-year sentence, or a 10-year sentence or a 15-year sentence, they were released, paroled, brought back into society and said, look, it's over. The past is the past. But it wasn't over for them. They lied to the Russians about reprogramming. Instead, in their basements and in hallways and in dark alleyways, they continued to organize and plot with the assistance of the Central Intelligence Agency, which continued to fund this movement all the way up until 1990. They're there. They're festering. They hate. They represent nothing but hate. And now today, if you're going to denazify Ukraine, that means you have to have a solution for these people. Now, I don't want to be too crude here, but the best solution is they all pick up a weapon and go to the front line and get killed. That's the best solution. It's the easiest solution. Self-termination. But some of them are going to get captured. And the Russians already have a solution for that. They have imprisoned many of these activists. Now, if you're guilty of a crime, you'll be tried in a court of law and held accountable to the rule of law. But many of these activists are being given a second chance. Denazification. And the Russians are honest about it, meaning they're giving them an opportunity to try and redefine their life, acknowledge the mistakes, etc. But, you know, how many times do the Russians have to be fooled? You know, are the people that are denouncing denazification doing so because they truly believe in renouncing the hateful ideology of Stepan Bandera? Or are they doing it to survive? Will they say anything just to get out of the situation that they're in? That's what they did back in the 1950s. There's no guarantee they're not going to do that again today. I'm not advocating that Russia kills prisoners. I'm not advocating that Russia does anything inhumane or in violation of international humanitarian law. I'm just saying that it's very difficult to reprogram people. In Germany, in the aftermath of World War II, the ideology of National Socialism, of Nazism, survived in the basements of the homes of many Germans, where they had shrines to the past glory. They weren't allowed to take these symbols out of their home, parade them in the street, but they did it in secret. And this is the future of Ukraine for anybody, any one of these Nazis who survives this conflict and doesn't flee or isn't killed. They're going to take this ideology into the basement, and it's never going to die. So that's why I say the only true solution is the bullet. So I'm hoping that every single one of these true believers puts on a uniform and goes to the front line. Is given the opportunity to die for their country.
Scott, Biden had a meeting with Justin Trudeau in Mexico. He said something so amazing. He said, I'm lucky. I got Canada to the north and Mexico to the south and two oceans on either side. I was thinking, who else is lucky? Russia's lucky? No. Ukraine. United States has Ukraine there. Is China lucky? No. Taiwan. Japan. this article, this interview, Financial Times, with U.S. Marine commander in Japan, he says, we are preparing for war with China. How do you see this? How do you see the relation between China and United States when a commander, he's a top commander, confessing that they're preparing to fight China?
Well, remember, the military commander only does what he is told to do. It's not as though this military commander woke up this morning and said, what are we going to do today? Let's prepare to go to war with China. No. He, remember, all our military leadership in America works for civilian leadership. That's the way it is. The civilians are in charge. We, in America, we publish a couple documents. We publish something called the National Security Strategy of the United States of America. It defines the strategic objectives and directions. That is then turned into something called the Defense Strategy, the National Defense Strategy. And that takes these broad objectives and further breaks them down to various services. And then each service commander reviews that and comes up with their own strategy on how to meet these objectives. coming out of the Marine Corps, General Berger, when he came in, he did a review, and he was brutally honest. He said, for years, the Marine Corps has not been complying with the mandates given to it by the National Security Strategy and the National Defense Strategy. So the Marine Corps has failed. The Marine Corps is not able to accomplish what they've been tasked to. The Marine Corps has married itself to what he called legacy tactics, legacy operations, legacy equipment, weapons, meaning legacy things in the past. You know, because the Marine Corps is a very successful military organization, we pride ourselves on our history, and so many people are unwilling to break free of historical attachments to the concept of Marines, you know, getting on an amphibious assault vehicle and going across the beach, doing a classic amphibious assault. That means that in order to do that, we have to have big amphibious vessels. But the nature of war has changed. We have area denial weaponry. As these ships come close to a shore to dislodge their Marines, they'll be sunk by missiles, and all the Marines on board will die. And so he said, why do we want to continue to do that if we're tasked with potentially confronting China in the South China Sea or defending Taiwan? If we've been ordered by our leadership to do this, and yet we're staying, you know, we're staying faithful to legacy, then we're not accomplishing the mission. So he said, I'm reevaluating the totality of how the Marine Corps operates. He got rid of tanks. He got rid of military police. He got rid of a number of things that he found that didn't directly support the mission the Marine Corps has been given. And he has asked his subordinate commanders to come up with what needs to be done to successfully fight China if they're called upon to do so. And so the Okinawa commander said, we're going to be prepared. We're going to reorganize so that we have long range strike capability so that we can strike China in case of a Chinese attack on Taiwan. It's not that he woke up in the morning and said, aha, I want to fight China. He's received his orders to be prepared to fight China, and he's executing those orders. So we shouldn't condemn or criticize the Marine commander for doing his job. What we should do is condemn the political leadership for promoting conflict when, at the end of the day, the Marine Corps won't be able to accomplish its mission regardless. China's a big, tough target. The Marine Corps is a very good organization, but it has limitations in terms of size. And because it's not a huge organization, that means that its lethality is limited to what it can bring to the table. It's also, you know, when Joe Biden brags about the Pacific, understand this. The Pacific, yes, it's a great defensive barrier because it means the enemy has to go all the way across the Pacific to get to us. But it also means we have to go all the way across the Pacific to get to the enemy. And that complicates things. So the Marine Corps has been put in an almost impossible situation, tasked with doing something that geography and just the reality of economics and, you know, military composition makes it virtually impossible to do.
I see. You see, Twitter files came out about the Russia that shows Russia has no interference in U.S. policy. It was just all made up. And how I wonder how many hours mainstream media spend on Russia. Russia is doing this, doing that, and finally nothing's come out.
Well, what's interesting is it's something I've known all along. I mean, back in 1998, I was hired by NBC News to be one of their on-air expert analysts, and I got to work very closely with their production team. Tom Brokaw, who was the head, National News Corps, talking head, all of their producers. And I did it for 6 months. And what I realized afterwards is that NBC works for the U.S. government. Just plain and simple. The NBC is not about telling the truth. NBC is about spinning a story in a way that benefits the United States government. That's it. Their reporters all have direct links to Pentagon, the White House, etc., and they won't do anything that upsets these links, because without these links, they don't get a story. Their job isn't to generate truth. Their job is to generate viewership. And you generate viewership by, you know, massaging a narrative in a way that can draw in the public without alienating the source of the information, which is the U.S. government. I saw this with CNN in 2002, and I've seen it with every major news, Fox News. I worked for them for a while. Ideology knows doesn't prevent corruption of ideals. No news network believes in the news. They all believe in viewership. It's all a business, and therefore they're all loyal to that which provides them the information that can generate viewership, which is the U.S. government. We saw this recently in April of last year when NBC News admitted that they received information from the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, that, you know, intelligence information that they know is wrong, that the U.S. government knows is wrong. But they release it anyways because their job isn't to tell the truth, but to shape a narrative. General Nakasone, the head of the National Security Agency, has admitted that he has personally authorized information to be released and given to CNN by name. He said CNN. So it gets on the air that night to what? Tell the truth? No, to shape the narrative, shape perception. So we know this is happening. Now we go to the Russian collusion case. We know it's made up. I mean, anybody who studied the story knows that Robbie Mook made it up in the aftermath of, when there was an alleged hack against the Democratic National Convention. Rather than tell the truth, which is we don't know what happened, it might have been an insider leaking information for all we know. We don't know. But instead, he manufactured the Russian hack, which then he said was evidence of collusion. And it wasn't just him. He did that. The FBI cooperated with them in this. To target Donald Trump and to try and accuse Donald Trump of being a Russian agent. The director of the CIA got involved and took a double agent who the CIA knew was a bad source and cleaned him up and took him straight to the president to promote the notion of Russian interference. And then when social media began to question the narrative, when social media began to say, it's not all adding up, they shut down social media. They control it. And that's what we see with the Twitter files. We see a direct collusion between the FBI, the Democratic Party, the United States government, and Twitter, a private company, to control the narrative. It's part of the process, to control the narrative, to emphasize one story and de-emphasize another, to deplatform anybody who dares challenge the narrative and to promote those who promote the narrative. Matt Taibbi deserves a Pulitzer Prize for what he's doing. So does Glenn Greenwald. Anybody who's going through the Twitter files and exposing the depth of the corruption of the U.S. government and Twitter as an organization deserves all the commendations they can get, because what transpired there isn't just about lying to the American people. It's the death of American democracy, because you're politicizing misinformation. I mean, one of the things I always say is when you have somebody up there shouting at the top of their lungs, as the Democrats did, the Russians are using social media to control the American people. And you go, no. What you should immediately say is they're mirror imaging. They're accusing the Russians of doing that which they are doing. Every single Democratic operative who is out there screaming at the top of their lungs about Russian collusion, about Russian bot farms, about Russian influence trolls, etc., are guilty of doing the exact same thing what they did with Twitter, Facebook, and other outlets. It's a frontal assault on one of the fundamental notions of American democracy, and that's free speech. Free speech. The Democrats don't believe in free speech. Neither does the U.S. government, and apparently neither did Twitter or Facebook.
We know that neocons and new liberals are together in this fight against Russia, in this hate against Russia. Why they're hating Russia so much that makes them capable of doing each and everything possible to harm Russia?
Well, let's put it this way. First of all, they don't hate Russia. Because you can't say you hate Russia if you don't know Russia, right? Let's say you're the symbol of Brazil right now, you, right? And I have a policy in Brazil I want to accomplish, but you're in the way. So I'm going to say that you're a murderer. I'm going to say that you're a rapist. I'm going to say that you have written books advocating the torture of puppies. I'm going to say you're the most evil person in the world. And people are going to say, my God, Scott, you hate him. No, because everything I just said about you isn't true. If it was true, then I could hate you. But it's not true. I don't hate you, but I am using you to create a symbol that can be hated. And I'm exploiting the ignorance of people by saying things about you that they are willing to accept at face value without question. So therefore, you become something else in the minds of others. But you're not deserving of this hate, because none of what I just said about you is true. It's all false. That's what's happening with Russia. We have what I call the Putin whisperers. You see, there's a class of people. We used to have genuine Russian experts, called Soviet experts back then, the people who studied the Soviet Union, studied Russia linguistically, culturally, historically, not for the purpose of falling in love with Russia, actually for the purpose of going to war with Russia. But, you know, the old adage, know your enemy as you know yourself. It means to be honest, to know your enemy honestly, to know them as they truly are. It took a lot of time. It took a lot of effort. I was one of those people. I didn't get the benefit of the decades of experience that some of my mentors did. But I was trained to understand Russia, not to hate Russia, to understand Russia, understand the Soviet Union, not to hate the Soviet Union. all this training was done in preparation for war, so I would have to kill these people. But I wasn't doing it based upon ignorance. I was doing it based upon a legitimate, detailed knowledge and understanding of the enemy. Then what happened is, as we transitioned into better relations through arms control, this knowledge and understanding enabled us to make that transition. You see, I didn't have to learn not to hate Russians, because I already knew the Russians and I didn't hate the Russians. I just simply had to adapt to a new reality that said, they're not my enemy. So I take the knowledge, the truth-based knowledge that I have about this problem set, and now I apply it to a new mission, which is peace, peaceful coexistence, disarmament. And it wasn't a difficult transition to make. I mean, emotionally it was difficult, because to go from enemy to friend is an emotional thing. But from a pure factual base, it wasn't hard. There was no inconsistency in my fact set, because this fact set readily transferred over here because it's the truth. But then the Soviet Union collapsed. And we had to transition now from a nation that we were having peaceful coexistence with to a new mindset, a defeated enemy. Now, making that transition was almost impossible unless you redefined the fact set. And that's what a lot of people did. They said, this is no longer the Soviet Union. So all you Soviet guys, I remember I applied in 1992, I did an interview with the CIA at the invitation of a senior CIA person. He said, why don't you come back and work with us on Russia? So I went up and I did an interview, and I was interviewed by the head of the new, they called it OREO at that time, Office of Russian European Affairs, something like that. And he basically said, your experience is no good to us. You're tainted. You're a Soviet guy. You have that old thinking. We need new thinking. I'm like, but the fact set hasn't changed. The fact set is the same. What do you need? You need a new way of thinking? What does that mean? What that means is they need people who will view Russia as a defeated enemy. People who aren't looking to peacefully coexist with Russia, but people who are looking to economically and politically exploit Russia. You see, the policy wasn't to live in peace. The policy was to destroy Russia, to dismember Russia, to cause it to collapse in upon itself. And this required the need to jettison the old hands and bring in new people like Michael McFaul. Michael McFaul is not a Russian expert. He's not, simply not. He's ignorant as the day is long about Russia. Michael McFaul is a Russian exploiter. You know, he cut his teeth on, the early Yeltsin years. He was one of the people that worked with the National Endowment for Democracy and other entities to breathe life into the viability of Yeltsin, to create the myth of Boris Yeltsin, which was little more than a vehicle for American control of Russia. And he was one of the people that sought to politically dominate and economically exploit Russia. He's an enemy of Russia who calls himself a Russian expert. The same thing is with this whole cast of characters that we call, Russian experts. I call them Putin whisperers. People like Fiona Hill, with her quaint little British accent, looking harmless because the second Americans hear a British accent, they melt and think that automatically it translates into she must be intellectually sound. She's not intellectually sound. What she is a fake, a fraud. She's somebody who wrote a PhD thesis about Vladimir Putin and autocracy and dictatorship. Vladimir Putin is not an autocrat. He's not a dictator. What he is a completely different kind of Russian leader than Boris Yeltsin was. He's a Russian leader who isn't willing to allow his country to be exploited and attacked and demolished by outside powers. He's a Russian leader that believes that Russia should stand on its own two feet and move forward. Is he perfect? No. Is everything he does, wonderful? No. But he's a million times better than Boris Yeltsin was. And what the United States wants to do is get rid of Vladimir Putin, who's very inconvenient to us, and replace him with a new Boris Yeltsin. In order to do that, we can't talk about the reality of Russia. I mean, most Americans today, we live in a nation that's undergoing its own economic difficulties. You don't have to travel too far away from where I live to find the Rust Belt, the old cities and towns that thrived during the age of industrialization, but have now suffered. Factories have closed down, businesses have shuttered, entire parts of the town is comprised of decaying homes where nobody lives and nobody will live. Reduced tax bases, which means reduced services. We've got problems here. If we did an experiment in the Rust Belt and we went back to say, let's pick 1999, and it had an American stand in front of one part of the city and took that picture, and then took that same picture, 2000, 2001, 2023. And then we did those, that card trick where you take images like we did as kids, where you draw stick figures that are running, and you go, and it looks like they're moving. Do that, and you'll see the American city or town decaying before your eyes, rotting away. Now let's do the same experiment to a Russian city. Start 1999. Anyone, pick them. I don't care which one. Do the same thing. You're going to see a city coming to life, being rebuilt, invigorated, modernized. Vladimir Putin has done wonderful things for Russia. Whether you like him or you hate him, you got to admit this. You got to at least be truthful about it. But we don't want to have that conversation in America, because most Americans would went, well, I like that kind of leader. Why don't we have that kind of leadership? What we have to do is attack Vladimir Putin. We have to attack the Russian nation. We can't talk about the reality of Russia. We can't talk about the complexity of Russia. We can't talk about the fact that it's the largest landmass country in the world. Therefore, multiple time zones, and that governing something of this expanse is complicated. So the notion of a singular figure dictating everything is absurd. Russia's broken down into districts that have governors. The governors have a lot of power, and the governors further delegate that responsibility to city mayors. Mayors have a lot of power. Decisions in Russia are made from the ground up. The up part, Vladimir Putin provides directives, a notion of the direction they want to head. But most of the time, those directives and the notion of the direction where they head come from discussions he's had with the governors and the mayors about what their needs are, what their wants are, what their capabilities are. So a good leader listens to that and then comes up with a plan that they support and they move forward. But we can't talk about that because that's too hard. You know, there's an old saying, when you're explaining, you're losing. So anybody who wants to promote a policy of confronting Russia, but then has to explain why that's a good policy in the face of the reality of Russia, is going to lose. So no, we reinvent a Russia, just like I reinvented you when I said I want to attack you. I tell a story that has nothing to do with the truth. I come up with stories that are just manufactured out of thin air. Stories that are designed to make people afraid, to fear. Ignorance is the worst thing, because from ignorance comes fear, and that fear can be exploited by people. So we've turned Vladimir Putin into the personification of evil. We've turned Russia into a nation of robots, people without a heart, without a soul, who blindly obey their leader, without any notion of the consequences of their actions. That's just not Russia. But the people today who are advising President Biden, who advise President Trump, who advise President Obama, who advise the next president, they're not Russian experts. They're the most dishonest class of academics America has ever known. They're people who promote hatred through ignorance. And if you call yourself an academic, if you're somebody who believes that knowledge is power, and you turn around and use that platform to exploit ignorance through misinformation to generate fear for political purposes, you deserve to be fired on the spot.
Scott, did you watch that documentary, The Rise of Putin? I don't know.
I did.
How did you find the documentary?
Well, first of all, understand that I have made a documentary.
You?
So I've made a film.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I did. Yes, I'm a filmmaker. I'm a director, a producer, a writer. Called In Shifting Sands. It dealt about Iraq. And I'm proud of the movie. I'm very proud of the movie. But I know what it takes to make a movie. And I know what editorial decisions had to be made to create a narrative, and how difficult it is sometimes to get the facts set to match the narrative you're trying to do. How difficult it is to do a project like this with integrity. I believe I did that. I'm not accusing the person who made this film of doing anything other than that. I'm just saying that, you know, people who watch a documentary don't understand. What they're seeing is the duck on the water, just smoothly moving around. What they don't see are the feet underneath going like this, how difficult it is to do something like this. And anybody who watched In Shifting Sands knows that in order for me to tell that story, I had to oversimplify extraordinarily complicated issues. I didn't lie, but you can't, you only have so much time. So you have to simplify things. You have to, pick and choose. And there were gaps in the narrative. There were things that have to be done, have to be jumped over, not because you're trying to deceive people, because you only have a limited amount of time to tell the story. And that's what happened here. I mean, it paints, a very compelling picture of Putin. I think it's something people should watch. But the only reason I'm saying this is that I think documentaries are the lazy person's way of trying to learn a subject. That the true way to learn about Vladimir Putin is to read all the books you can read, to view all the totality. The way I'd like to see this documentary is for him to release every interview he did in totality, so that you don't see the editor's choice. You see everything. You see the hesitation on the part of someone when you ask them a question. You see them struggle. You see them start an answer, stop, and then re-answer. And all that, that's all I'm saying. I mean, yes, I saw it, but I think it painted a generally positive portrait of Vladimir Putin. And I'm not against a positive portrait of Vladimir Putin.
I think so.
But I'm against oversimplification.
I do think this way, that it was a good picture of Putin because it was.
Yeah. No, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not attacking. I'm just saying that I think Vladimir Putin himself, in a moment of honesty, away from the cameras, would say, I'm a little bit more complicated than that. It's not that easy. It's not that simple. That's all I'm trying to say. I mean, I like it, but I think sometimes you do a disservice to a person of such historical importance as Vladimir Putin by creating a overly simplified positive portrait. I think if Vladimir Putin, I don't think is afraid of the truth. I think if the whole truth was laid out there about Vladimir Putin, he would still come off on the very far along on the good scale. He's not going to come off as an evil person, a bad person, a disingenuous person. I think he's going to come off as a very, very good leader for Russia and a good person. And we should trust that process, not try to massage that process by creating smooth documentaries. That's all I'm saying. I mean, I liked it, but the problem with it is that it can be attacked and will be attacked by the other side as, pro-Putin propaganda. You can't win. You can't win any, dealing with Vladimir Putin or Russia. I mean, if you did a documentary about Russia that showed Russia in its true state, for all the good, the bad, the warts, beauty, everything, people say, well, that's pro-Russian propaganda. Because at the end of the day, Russia is going to come out on the good scale. Despite all of its problems, all of its difficulties, all of its history, Russia's still a good country. It's a good nation with good people. They don't have to hide behind anything to get to that conclusion. But the problem is, in telling that story, if you try to, Photoshop away the pimple and, cover up that scar and let's get rid of that wart, people are going to look at the picture and say, that's propaganda. It's not the truth. I don't think the Russians are afraid of the pimple, the scar, or the wart. They're like, yeah, I got a pimple, I got a scar, I got a wart. Yeah, so what? This is me. And what me is good. That's all I'm saying. I'm just against the process of photoshopping history.
I see. I don't know if you heard about, we had here in Brazil, in Brasilia, the capital of Brazil, we had something like January 6th protest.
Yeah.
Do you think that CIA had a role in this protest?
First of all, I don't have any proof. So, I can't sit here and say, I know something you don't know. I don't know anything. What I can say is this. The CIA maintains a station in Brazil. Okay, it's run by a senior case officer whose entire life is dedicated to carrying out the national security tasking of the U.S. government. A CIA case officer assigned to Brazil is not a friend of Brazil. He's a friend of the United States. He's there to promote the policy of the United States. He's not a diplomat. He might operate under diplomatic cover, but he's not a diplomat. He's a spy. His job is to run a human intelligence collection operation that is supported by parallel technical intelligence collection, whether it be signals intelligence or other variations of that theme. He's a spy. He's an enemy of Brazil, disguised as a friend of Brazil, a diplomatic cover, running a network of people whose job it is, stated straight up, to get Brazilians to betray their country by agreeing to spy on behalf of the United States. The CIA's job is to get you to betray your country by giving me the secrets of your country. That's the job of the CIA. I'm not making it up. We know what their job is. So the case officer is out there. Now, these case officers, depending on their age and their experience, aren't very good. And what I mean by that is they, human intelligence is a difficult target. You want to get close to people. Sometimes political leaders make themselves readily available. I don't know if Bolsonaro has any ties to the United States that makes him directly accessible to the CIA. I don't know if Lula does. I know that the CIA has made it their mission to get close to either one of these two guys, both, so that they can understand what's going on and, if possible, influence them, either directly or indirectly. So you need to build a network of what they call access agents. If you can't get directly to Bolsonaro, and sometimes you don't want to get directly to Bolsonaro because you have to create the notion of deniability. Because if it's too easy to trace CIA money to the president of Brazil, the president of Brazil is not going to last very long. So you need cutouts. You need people close to him, and then you need people close to them. And then so you have to recruit a network of access agents. That's hard work, very hard work, because Brazil's got a counterintelligence organization that's trying to prevent that very thing from happening. So all the legwork, the casework, it's hard work. CIA case officers tend to be drunks, alcoholics, sex addicts, everything, because it's a tough life. And they end up getting drunk, taking prostitutes, and then they're called upon, hey, how many people have we recruited today? I got to get my numbers up. So they go out and they find a taxi driver. And the taxi driver says, yeah, every once in a while I drive this woman who address her for the wife of this politician who sometimes meet with Bolsonaro. Oh. So they hire the taxi driver to tell them stories about what this woman hairdresser says about this. And then they turn those stories into fiction that they sell. They get money to pay the taxi driver, but they put some of that money in their own pocket because they lie. This is what they do. The CIA is corrupted from the very bottom. What I'm trying to say is when you have thousands of disaffected Brazilians camped outside of the Brazilian Ministry of Defense, chanting pro-Bolsonaro things, the CIA knows about this. And so they went down there, and I'm sure they recruited some taxi drivers, some truck drivers, some prostitutes, some food vendors, something like that. They were aware that this was happening. Doesn't mean the CIA was controlling it. I don't have any evidence of that. I think this was the same dynamic that exists here in the United States. Brazil is a nation that's deeply divided politically. And the division has manifested itself in a way that neither side wants to talk to each other. They hate one another. They dislike one another. So the Bolsonaro supporters don't trust the Lula supporters, and the Lula supporters don't trust the Bolsonaro supporters. What invariably happens when you lose faith and trust in the government, you lose faith and trust in all of the institutions, to include the electoral system. So you begin to automatically say that the system is fraudulent. We saw that here in the United States. I'm not saying that there's evidence of fraud. There's suspicion of fraud. And, you know, there was a Baker report written a while back about mail-in ballots in the United States. And what it said is, while using mail-in ballots does not in and of itself mean fraud will happen, the system itself is conducive to fraud, therefore it creates the perception of fraud. So even if you have a mail-in ballot system that works flawlessly, no one's going to trust it, because the perception of fraud will always exist. So anytime you have an election that hinges on mail-in ballots, people will view it as fraudulent, especially people who don't trust the party that won. So that's what happened here in the United States. We have people driven by a political leader, Donald Trump, who told them that the election was fraudulent, and they were able to convert their anger over their perception of fraudulent, not necessarily the reality of fraud, but the perception, into political action that led to the January 6th riot. I think that happened in Brazil. Bolsonaro called the election a fraud. His supporters believed him. The perception of fraud existed. I'm not saying there was reality. I think most observers say, no, the election was okay. It was done properly. Yeah. But that doesn't matter. There's a perception of fraud. They don't want to believe that it was done properly because they disagree with the outcome. And because they're not willing to work with the other side, they wanted to forcefully overturn the results. And what you got was the January 6th type moment. I don't think the CIA is sophisticated enough to run something like that. Remember, all the CIA case officers in Brazil is a bunch of drunk, drug-using, prostitute-using losers. And I mean that seriously. These are guys who spend their career lying for a living, and that creates sort of an internal rot. They're not sophisticated enough to run that kind of operation. That kind of operation comes from the nation itself, which tells you something. Brazil, like the United States, is fundamentally broken.
Yeah, exactly. It is. And Scott, let's talk about the last question about the Julian Assange. Do you think that U.S. going to drop its charges against Julian Assange? Is there any chance out there?
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. Let me put it this way. If I've lost faith with the American judicial system and the American court system a long time ago. But I believe in the possibility of justice. And if Julian Assange was actually brought to an American courtroom and these charges were put up before an American judge who respected the rule of law, respected the Constitution, these charges would be dismissed. Dismissed. Julian Assange would be freed. I think that there might be some people in the Justice Department who understand the risk of bringing him in. Also understand that the closer this comes to the potential of his deportation and arrival here in the United States, the more the American mainstream media is forced to reflect on what's about to happen. A journalist is about to be prosecuted for exercising the very same free speech rights that they possess. That if Julian Assange is prosecuted, they all are subject to prosecution. And so I think for the first time, these mainstream media outlets are saying, whoa, 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 whoa. That's why you're seeing people at the top start to say, no, 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 you should free Assange, free Assange, free Assange. So I think Assange will be freed in a way that doesn't require the U.S. government to admit his innocence, but also in a way that avoids prosecution that could produce de facto proof of his innocence. So they'll maintain the fiction that he did something wrong, but he'll go free without ever having his day in court. And I think that's a possible, if not probable, outcome. And for his sake, I hope it happens. He has a wife. He has children. He needs to be with his family. He needs to live as a free man. And frankly speaking, he should be allowed to return to the job he did so effectively. That is to be a journalist whose job is to expose the lies and deceit of government to the people.
Scott, what's wrong? Because we know these journalists went after presidents in the United States. In those days, in those old days, they were so effective. They were so powerful. But now everything is corrupt.
Yeah.
How they can? They're not missing those old days.
No, because it's changed. Remember, when you went after corruption back then, your job was to report the news. I mean, you take a journalist like Seymour Hersh, finest investigative journalist America's the world's ever known. His job was to get the truth. And he had editors who allowed him to get to the truth, and they published his stories. But later on, as the news business changed and became less about news and more about business, his stories became inconvenient to the editors. You see, the editors work for institutions that are, deeply affected by sources of funding. How else do editors get to hold their big luncheons and whiskey and, go to parties and walk around with their funky looking tweed coats and scarves and say, I'm an intellectual, I'm this, host this function? Who pays for that? Who pays for that? Not the profit-generating news business. Who pays for that is somebody underwriting it, because all of that is a tool to create perception, to shape public perception. So people are underwriting the news business, not to tell the truth, but to shape perception. And sometimes the truth is horribly inconvenient. This is why people like Cy Hirsch, when they try to find the truth about Abu Ghraib, when they tried to find the truth about Iraq, about what was going on in Iran, about what was going on in Afghanistan, started hitting their heads against brick walls, because the publishers were being told by the people who fund the publishers, we don't want that story. That story is inconvenient to the narrative. So America has killed investigative journalism, real investigative journalism. Yes, we have some very good independent journalists out there. We do. But it's very difficult to joust against windmills in a Quixote-type endeavor if you're not even allowed to, get on the horse to begin with. Independent journalists are always on the outside looking in. Very rarely do they get the opportunity that Matt Taibbi has right now to go through, the actual primary materials. Independent journalists are chipping away on the fringes. They do a good job of connecting the dots, but it's very difficult for them to get to the heart of the story. And when they do, for instance, ask Glenn Greenwald why he left The Intercept. The Intercept became too successful, too good at doing what it was doing. So it was bought out. New money came in that took control of the narrative. And Glenn Greenwald, with his integrity, couldn't be part of that anymore, so he left. But you know, he's not getting the phone call now from, you know, the Secretary of Defense or the Undersecretary of this or this or that, you know, because he's not part of the game. The only people that get those phone calls are the people who are playing the game. And the game isn't about truth. It's about business, generating business. So American journalism has lost touch with that which once defined it, the integrity, the unbiased desire to find the truth no matter what, no matter where the chips fell, tell the story the way the story must be told. Nobody's doing that anymore. They're all shaping the story to fit a narrative. But even then, they recognize that if Julian Assange was successfully prosecuted for doing the same job they do, but doing it better. And that's why they are so angry at him. You see, Julian Assange was better at the job of journalism than they were. His sources were better. His documents were better. And he had the courage to publish things that they wouldn't publish. So they hate Julian Assange. They hate him. And if he could be prosecuted in England far away, they'd be happy with that. They were happy with what was going on with the Swedes. Now to bring him to American shores and bring him up where the First Amendment will be attacked will affect all of them as well. So I think that's why we're seeing a change in heart, not because they all suddenly woke up imbued with a desire to become integrity-infused journalists. No, they just don't want to be prosecuted by the U.S. government for receiving a phone call in the middle of the night from somebody who's, you know, releasing information that they're legally not allowed to.